Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name is Heather Neal and I'm joined by Blanche McIntyre, whose English touring theatre production of Arcadia is still to arrive in Aylesbury and Birmingham, Oxford, Cambridge and Malvern. Well, Blanche McIntyre is a multi-award-winning young director, the recipient of Critics Circle, Offie and TMA Awards, whose previous work includes The Seagull in Southampton, the comedy of Errors at the Globe, and Emmeline Williams' Accolade. And now she's casting for her next project, As You Like It, due to open at the Globe in May. But we're here to talk about Arcadia. So, first of all, the word Arcadia comes out of Et in Arcadia Ego, which is a sort of ambivalent term. Is that something you bore in mind in rehearsal, the sort of dual meaning of the whole phrase?
Of course. Well, I heard that it was the original title that Tom Stoppard wanted for his play, Et in Arcadia Ego, and it's drawn from the title of a Poussin painting, two Poussin paintings, in fact, where some shepherds discover it written on a tomb. And so, although, as you know, I'm sure, in Latin, it simply means, and in Arcadia, I. It can be taken as death speaking in Arcadia. Even in the most beautiful pastoral landscape, you still find the Grim Reaper. Yeah. And that's absolutely what the play is about. I think it goes to the heart of it, that that one can be in Lady Croom's beautiful landscaped garden, one can be in the lush landscape of academia, one can be living one's life with the sum of with the greatest amount of available happiness, and still underneath there is waste, there is disorder, and there will be death.
Yes, and of course there is, we are told, going to be a tragic death at the end of the play, which we don't have to see, but we know that all that so much promise is going to be lost.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that the play deals with, that's at the heart of the play. There's a speech early on by Septimus where he talks about how across human civilization the same discoveries will be made. Nothing is ever truly lost. He says we pick up as we go. The journey is very long, life is very short, but nothing is outside the march, so nothing can be lost to it. And over the course of the play, one of the things you realise is that isn't true, that there are losses which are irrecoverable, and that one of the theories that the play deals with is the entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, which is the fact that energy in a closed system becomes usable energy decreases over time, so gradually heat is lost to the universe, energy is lost to the universe is running down. So the play itself, the theories that are dealt with in the play, disprove Septimus's theory that everything will be found again, and the death that, the tragedy that happens at the end of it is an absolute proof of that.
Yes. Perhaps we ought to say something about who these people are and what's going on in the play, in case anyone who's listening doesn't know about it. Because it happens in two separate periods, doesn't it? 1806 and 1812, and present day. And I was going to ask you about that. Is your present day 1993, which is when the play was written?
It is. It's 1809, in fact, and 1812.
Oh, sorry, I said 1806.
That's
yes,
right.
1809, yes.
Yes, exactly. It happens in two time frames, in 1809 and 1812.
Yes.
There is a young, we would say, mathematical prodigy. She's discovering these extraordinary things about the way that maths work, which in which she's ahead of the game by about 200 years in some cases. And then the other part of the play takes place in 1993 and is about academics in the same house who are trying to find out who she was, what happened to her, what her discoveries meant. And there is a young mathematician there as well who is able to say how to find out and then to explain how extraordinary and radical the discoveries that she made were. So if you like, you have one period which is looking forward to the future, excited about what it will bring and making discoveries, and then you have another period which is looking back at the past and trying to make discoveries in its turn about that.
And then at the end we see all the characters on stage together, so there's a kind of blending of the periods, rather cleverly done, because the modern ones are dressing up in costume of the earlier period for a sort of pageant thing that they have the people in the Grand House, because it all takes place in the Grand House called Sidley Park in Derbyshire.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think there's a quote by Stoppard that's from, I can't remember where he said it, that the structure of the play reflects the theories in it. And so this mixing, this loss of energy into the atmosphere, and the other thing that he deals with, chaos theory, is about systems which can't be predicted, unpredictable behaviour. And between them, they deal with disorder in a system. Apparently random effects. And so you start off in the play with very clearly defined time periods, and as it goes on, they mix together, past and present mix, and the various poles that he deals with, the classical temperament, the romantic temperament, science and arts, all mix together. And so by the end, you have this extraordinary, as you say, both periods on stage at once. Yeah.
Well, it is an extraordinary play because it deals with these very difficult scientific and mathematical concepts. But there's also a lot of literary theory in it and the history of landscape gardening and reference to the Enlightenment and Romanticism. There is so much. Was it difficult in rehearsals to think how you were going to make it all clear to an audience? Because we have heard Tom Stoppard apparently saying recently, though I think this was exaggerated because I was there, that the audiences are dumbed down, can't really get what he's talking about. I mean, were you aware that you had to be terribly clear?
Well, yes, it was a huge concern. But I think one of the things in the play, one of the joys of it, is the way that he makes it very clear. So when he's talking about mixing, for example, he doesn't talk about atoms or chaos theory. He never mentions it by name. He talks about how when you stir jam into a rice pudding, you can't unstir it again. And that's something that everyone is familiar with. And when he's talking about the second law of thermodynamics, he talks about how tea gets cold by itself and it doesn't get hot by itself, and that everything is gradually going towards room temperature in the same way. So he uses ways of talking about these difficult ideas which make them very accessible. But I think there's an underlying question that I think you're asking about about dealing with difficult subjects in a play. And there's a speech towards the end where one of the characters says it doesn't matter what you're dealing with, the point is it's wanting to know that makes us matter. And I think that is what the play is all about, really. It's curiosity, it's being interested, that's the important thing. You don't actually have to know, but you need to come to it with an open mind and a desire to find out. And then if you do that, you pick up... It sort of doesn't matter how much you pick up. It is all there to pick up. But it's the human desire to find things out that's the
point. Well, there is also a very human story in this play, and there are lot of emotion and lot of
jokes
and romance.
Yes, sex and romance, exactly. It's absolutely not a lecture. It's about human beings struggling with what they know, with what they feel. It's a very human set of stories, I think.
Well, I think one of the fun things about it is the way we know what happened in 1809 and 1812 and how the academics later on get things wrong.
Yes.
And it's so nice to know more than they do and to see them falling over themselves.
It's lovely, isn't it? And in fact, I'm sure that sort of, in some ways, it's what happens isn't so interesting as how you find out. It's how people go about things that is that's the pointed issue.
Mm. Yes, well, another thread through the play is free will and determinism, isn't it?
Yes.
Did you do a lot of work on that sort of thing? Did you?
We talked about it. I didn't get a philosopher in to talk. I perhaps should have done. I don't know. There's something rather lovely about sitting down and talking about ideas just per se. But yes, you're right. There's a moment very, very late on where a character has to make a choice. Which we know he's going to make the wrong choice, and all kinds of pressures are being borne on him to make the right choice, but he makes it partly as a way of because he needs to be free to choose, and it's what he wants to do, and in the teeth of all this pressure he asserts his right to do his thing. And there is something I think very powerful about that, that you don't know what's going to come. So the only thing that you can do is choose what's right for you at that moment.
Mm. Yes, it's sort of... since these characters are all invented by someone, they can't possibly have any free will, can they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, writers do say that characters take over.
Yes.
Perhaps if you're a really good writer, then the sign of it is that your characters do have free will.
Well, the big question often is, who is the hermit? Which I think is because there's a hermitage built as part of the newly designed mm-hmm. garden. And Thomasina, the brilliant young mathematician, who's only 13 at the beginning, sort of draws one in, which is then taken to be a portrait of...
Yes, I think the hermit is who you think it is.
Yes.
The hermit is who they name in the play.
Well,
you
exactly.
do get to know him. Yeah. There's something.
Quite a lot of clues, actually.
I think there are, but I think it's, and I don't want to give your audience spoilers, but I think there is something very. That there is a sense of waste in the story of the hermit as well. That the man yes. who becomes the hermit, who devotes his life to. As you learn very early on in the play, writing and writing and writing, covering sheets of paper with mathematical equations which will never come to anything. There is something awful about that, the fact that that is that man's fate.
Yes, and again a sense of waste, because if he had been born 200 years later, he'd have had a computer.
And it would have been fine.
Yes.
Yes, that's the awful thing, isn't it? And it gives the lie again to that speech of Septimus's, that we will find it. Sometimes you need to be at the right point to find it. Mm. Sometimes people are born too early. Thomasina is also born too early.
Yes, and dies too early.
Dies too early, yes.
But behind the whole thing is the figure of Byron, who never appears, but he sort of hovers over the whole thing. And Septimus is a sort of a simulacrum in a way, isn't he?
Well,
a little bit.
In a way, it's. I suppose the thing about Byron is you can never bring Byron on stage. How could you? How could you bring somebody that charismatic, that intelligent, that funny, that sexy on stage? The poor actor playing him would have a terrible time. And I think the problem for Septimus is that he isn't Byron. He would quite like to be, but he's in love with Lady Croom, which is something that Byron is never in love. Well, he is, but he doesn't have that fixedness of passion that Septimus has. And Septimus is in many ways very self-destructive, as was Byron, but there is always a sense with him that he's living up to something that he isn't.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is something Byron never did.
But the academics in the play, as in other plays by Stoppard, not least The Hard Problem, the recent one, the new one, they get quite they get shown to us as very flawed people, shall we say. They're often very bitchy and jealous and...
Well, I suppose...
And ambitious.
I think academics are just real people as well. I suppose that's a very fatuous thing to say. But what's interesting about these two is that their work is informed by their personality flaws. So you have one specialist on Byron, and part of his problem is that he'd quite like to be Byron, but of course he isn't. But the way that he behaves is very much informed by his ideas about Byron. And the other academic who's very, very...
This is Hannah.
Hannah, who's very guarded. It's said very early on in the play, before you even meet her. She takes care of herself, she protects herself. And that is a... in many ways, a psychologically unhealthy thing to do. Mm. She's so...
She refuses to have any proper contact with any other human being, really, doesn't she? She
does.
Very self-contained.
Except intellectually. She absolutely does. Mm. And one of the journeys for Hannah, I think, is that she starts out in the ha-ha, devoted to the ideas, to this hermit, that there is a, that she only has one... mention of in she only has one source for, and by the end her world has been opened up to the extent that she will waltz with the youngest son of the house. She goes on a journey in a way that Bernard, the other academic, doesn't, and part of it, I think, is about lowering some of those walls. Mm.
Because, in fact, several of the males are in love with her, aren't they?
Yes, both the brothers of the stately home are desperately in love with this woman.
Yeah. Now, the younger one you've just mentioned...
Gus,
yes. The actor who plays him also plays the similar character in the earlier period, and that is specified by Stoppard. You're supposed to sort of see them as the same but not the same, but the second one, Gus, is absolutely tongue-tied.
Yes,
the modern period
boy, yes, he is, he doesn't speak. Again, there's a quote, I wish I could remember the source for it, but it's another line by Stoppard, that Gus doesn't speak because there are some things in the universe that you just can't explain. And Gus is a symbol of there not being a reason for some things.
Mm. Yes, well, he's in love with Hannah, and the thing he gives her is an apple. So this is this
yes.
another reference to Arcadia.
Oh, it's a lovely thing, isn't it? It's exactly, it's a pastoral symbol, but of course it's also the symbol of forbidden knowledge from the Bible. Yeah. And it's the apple leaf that Thomasina will find an equation for and iterate. So it's yeah. It's a mathematical symbol and an artistic symbol and a religious symbol as well, a spiritual one.
It also turns into food in the play as well because it gets eaten.
It does get eaten. We have to wire the leaf to it every day.
Did you do a lot of background work on, say, Byron? And
yes, we did. Well, I suppose it's you have to do background work on all of it. So yeah. So we did a lot of work. For example, we did a lot of work on Byron. We did a lot of work on theories of landscape gardening, how Stowe, for example, classical gardens evolve and become symbolic presentations of the personality of the gardener, which of course is very much what's going on in Arcadia, and then how they go to much more via Repton to much more, I think, is it a Hawksmoor? I can't remember. There's a very strong romantically designed garden in Wales.
Oh, okay.
The idea of how God is present and what nature is and what humans' relationship with nature is evolves over a period of time, and that, of course, is explained in the play, explored in the play. And so we did a lot of work on that, and of course, all the maths did a lot of looking at that as well. So there's a universe.
It's a
complete education. It really is. Renaissance man.
Well, one of the characters, the one who is keen on the garden, is Lady Croom.
Yes.
She's a marvellous character, isn't she? She's quite wildian. She comes out with some amazing lines.
She absolutely is. And one of the things that we discovered is that that she and her brother are not... they have, rather like Lady Bracknell, they don't themselves come from an aristocratic background. And that seemed to be a very interesting parallel with, because it's those Wildean quips, that a lot of the time with Wilde, his characters are self-made, and their use of language is a way of controlling the world around them. And it's a power game as much as it is anything else. And that was a very interesting thing when we came to look at Lady Croom, that she is also self-created, posed woman of the world, woman of the aristocracy, and her brother is a mere captain. That they're not themselves.
Yeah, and not nearly as bright as she is.
Oh, he's lovely, isn't he? When we were rehearsing, one of the rehearsals we did was a sort of ping pong of atoms rehearsal, and when you talk to somebody, you'd walk over and say it in their face, and with Captain Bryce, that worked so well that we kept it.
Well, there are various characters off stage who also seem to have a really strong presence in the play, like Lady Chater, the wife... Mrs. Chater, the wife of the poet who is put down by a review by Septimus, but quickly brought round by flattery, which is a rather brilliant scene.
Absolutely.
But his wife, whose name is Charity, I think not by accident, she's very charitable to
everyone. She's also ahead of her time. It's in the modern age, everyone's saying, well, Chloe's old enough to vote in her back, it doesn't matter who she sleeps with, no one's going to judge. Yeah. And in 1809, of course, it gets you the most appalling reputation.
Yeah.
But she simply has a modern attitude to sex. And she's married to this poor writer who is clearly not interesting enough to hold her attention.
Yeah.
Or at least not interesting enough in the way that she would like.
But Lady Croom also has a few flings, doesn't she?
She absolutely does, and I think it's one of the lovely things about the play that although Mrs. Chater, I think it's a want of style that gets attacked, Lady Croom has all the style in the world, and likewise a very modern attitude to extramarital affairs, and nobody minds.
And Septimus is really in love with her.
I think he is.
Yeah.
And I think that's... For a long time, and I think that's his... in some ways, it's his undoing. It's the reason why he makes that choice at the end.
Mm.
And in some ways, it's the thing that redeems him from otherwise being a rather self-destructive, clever youth whose sympathy we would never have.
Mm. Well, in both periods, there's a tortoise on the table.
Might be the same tortoise. They live for a long time.
But and in both periods, they have a marvellous name.
Mm.
Perhaps we should say first of all he's Plautus, and
yes,
then he's Lightning, which
yes,
is marvellously ironic. But all the characters have rather marvellous names, in fact, don't they? And very much period aware too.
They do. They have wonderful names, and I should mention in passing that my cast also have, in many cases, wonderful names: Larrington Walker, Wilf Scolding, and Dakota Blue Richards. Yeah. It's not just a period thing, but yes, Lady Croom is a terrific name. Charity Chater is a terrific name.
Yeah.
There's a spice of poetry in the names, I think.
There is. But we started talking about Gus and Augustus.
Yes.
You know, Jim Hunter, who's written a lot about...
Yes, yes.
He suggests there might be a sort of indication of something paranormal here. Are we supposed to feel anything like that? Or is it just, this is as if we are at one period delving back a little bit into another before they mix at the end? And of course, they don't know they're mixing at the end.
I don't know. It's an interesting suggestion. I think it might be better to use the term mystery than paranormal.
Yes.
But there's something that can't... There is a parallel that's hard to explain. It could simply be a family face. It could be more than that. And I know that there's a stage direction at the very end of the play that Gus appears, and it takes a moment to realise that he isn't Lord Augustus.
Yes, because he's dressed in similar period clothes,
yes,
because they're all dressing up.
Yes, yes.
It's such a clever device, isn't it?
It is a wonderfully clever device, but I suppose just pursuing your paranormal idea for a second, that would imply that time is cyclical, which I suspect that the theory of the universe running down rather argues that it isn't.
Yes.
So if there is a pattern that goes on, it's more like the chaos theory pattern that we're talking about, where things are self-similar, where patterns repeat themselves across time, but it isn't that time itself comes back.
Okay, and he kind of stands for that rather neatly.
I suppose he does.
Yeah.
I never thought of that until you suggested it.
Well, I think this play seems to me to be the ultimate Stoppard play. I mean, I don't know if you think that.
I love so many Stoppard plays. I love the invention of love, which this play seems to look forward to.
Yeah.
And I love the real thing, which this play rather looks back to in many ways, in the way that it deals with emotional mess. But yes, it does. It has everything, doesn't it?
Yes. But yes, that is something that people complain about in Stoppard sometimes, don't they? They say it's all ideas and not enough.
Yes,
emotion,
but I would disagree with that. I think they're very emotional plays.
Certainly Arcadia is, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's very moving, especially at the end.
I think so. And and you come out thinking, given that we're all going to die, how do you live? But you also come out feeling for the characters.
Yes, and concerned about waste, especially the young people.
Yes, exactly.
And then at the end, we're given a clue that... Hannah, the academic, who's going to write a book called, with a rather brilliant title, The Genius of the Plays, with a pun in it, is being given the proof she needs. But not a lot is made of that. We're just left to realise it, aren't we?
Yes, I suppose.
Because she wants proof. This is the proof of who the hermit is. So
it is.
It's left to us to think about.
I suppose that's the thing, that it's if it was hammered home with more force, it would feel like the play was a whodunit, or who was it, and that because it's sketched in very lightly, you can go away and work it out later. But it's it allows the play to be about so many more things than that.
Yeah.
And it's rather lovely that that Bernard, who feels like he's got all the ideas, is ultimately proved wrong.
Yeah.
But Hannah, who proceeds carefully and slowly and who gives up a lot to this quest for knowledge, ultimately she's allowed that one little piece of grace, which is she does find the answer at the end.
Yes, and provided by the boy
who loves
love with her.
Yes.
And can't speak about it.
Exactly.
But Bernard, on the other hand, is the other academic who's terribly flashy and has been on breakfast television and is now going to come cropper and has got to more or less hide when the photographs are taken.
Of course, and it's in some ways it's a rather tragic story that that he has a fatal flaw. He goes much too fast. He doesn't wait to shore up his idea with evidence, and of course that's what brings him down in the end. He doesn't wait to check.
He's pretty nasty to Hannah, though, describing her book as a novelette. She's written a book about Byron and Lady Caroline Lamb.
But then she describes him as a child peddling at Stratford Off Cliff. The gloves come off with the academics. They're very brutal to each other.
And it's very fast and very funny, that.
Yes, yes, yes. And they fight very hard. And in some ways, there's something rather lovely about that. Two people who don't mind. Valentine, of course, minds the conflict immensely, and he can't take it, and he has to leave.
And yes, he gets very upset.
He does, but Hannah doesn't.
No, that's right.
She just proves him wrong.
They both say it's no fun when it's not prose, don't they?
Yes.
I mean, the ordinary civilians can't cope with it.
Yes, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It's both less and more important. At the same time, they don't mind the fight, but then Hannah goes away and carefully finds the thing which will undo Bernard.
That's right, and she doesn't mind writing a letter to the Times to undo him.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So she takes it much more seriously over in the long term, but in the short term she doesn't mind a fight.
Yeah. Yes, that's all very enjoyable. And of course, there is also a certain amount of, not exactly criticism, but maybe having a bit of fun at the expense of class, about the upper classes.
Yes, and going back to what you asked before, that's why we had to set it in 1993.
Ah.
Apart from, there's obviously the maths has evolved since then enormously. There's a huge, every year more breakthroughs happen, but so we had to pin it to that moment, of course. Mm. But also there is an attitude to the aristocracy, to the stately homes. There are things that they get away with. This clearly appalling father who won't have a car in the house of his car in the grounds of his Japanese, and people sort of take that for granted. I was looking at it thinking, could we update it? And I thought, if we do, actually these characters will seem hateful, and Valentine can't seem hateful. He's just a product of his time. Mm-hmm. And Bernard would seem crawling in a way that, again, would... we were in the Meiji years at the time. It was before New Labour. There was a very, very different sense of what class was and how rigidly stratified it was. And I think we've moved on since 1997, since the 2000s. Of course, the idea of how society works continually evolves. We're in a very different period now again. But that was why it had to be 1993, because the class attitudes were very much of their time.
Yes, they talk very disdainfully about the villagers who are going to come into the marquee and will have to be allowed to go through to a loo. So they've cleared everything out of the way.
I don't know if they do. They talk protectively about this one time that a teapot was stolen, and that they are looking after what they feel it's their duty to guard.
Okay, fair enough, yes. You don't know who might turn up. It might not be your villagers after all.
It could be anyone, but... Yes. But yes, you're right, there's certainly, they give a dance for the district and they feel that that's a duty. And there's a moment where Valentine, in an overwhelming moment of hurt, says, "I don't care to be rubbished by the dustbin man." And that's a 1,000 years of aristocracy coming out there. Yeah. Or at least 300 years, I think. But they're quite old-fashioned in some senses, if you scratch them.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, they are... amazing to watch, and one still wants to go and see this play over and over again, and actually read it again afterwards.
Oh yes,
and follow up all the ideas that have been set going in it.
Well, I think that's one of the lovely things about the play. It bears out what Hannah says. It makes you curious.
Mm.
I read it and I want to know about why something can't be predicted, why a dripping tap can't be predicted, and what is an algorithm of a leaf? Could you draw a leaf through maths? You become more interested in the world around you as a result of having read it or seen it, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I feel well. I'll go away and do some more reading.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with As You Like It. Looking forward to that.
Thank you.
With Michelle Terry as Rosalie.
Couldn't be luckier with that.
Yeah. Thank you, Blanche.
Thank you.